Hello there, and welcome to Beyond the Surface, where the saying to be seen is to be understood comes to life. I want to begin by first honoring the traditional custodians of the land we live and work on. I live and work on Gundungurra land, and I acknowledge the traditional landowners of my guests near and far. I pay my respects to the elders past, present, and emerging, for they hold the memories, the traditions, and cultures of our First Nations people. The land below my feet is, was, and always will be Aboriginal land. I'm no stranger to the profound journey of pain, grief, anger, and heartbreak that often accompanies the loss of church, community, faith, and the unwinding of our core beliefs. In the midst of this, though, I found healing in the stories shared by others who walked a similar path to me. Here in the warmth of these digital walls, I want you to feel at home. This is a space where your memories and your story is not just acknowledged, but deeply seen and believed. So kick back, relax, and let's embark on a journey where your story is not just heard, but embraced. I want to welcome you to a community where storytelling is a powerful force. This is Beyond the Surface.
Hey Tim, thanks for joining me.
Sam, hello. Thank you for having me. You're in Australia, right?
It is
Wow.
bright and early, 5 a.m. over here.
Oh my, you are too kind to accommodate. You didn't have to do it that early. I could have moved a few things.
No, it's fine. It
Okay.
was fine. It's worth it. I'm happy to jump up and
Oh.
have a chat with you. So it's
So
good.
kind. Thank you.
So
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
yeah, it's great. I've only just sort of begun having these chats with people, and obviously I'm a therapist, so I sort of do it for my job. But I love hearing people's stories. It's my favorite thing in the world, I think. I think it's, where you get to meet people, understand people from a different angle.
Yeah. Oh, for
So,
sure. For sure.
yeah.
I'm all about it.
Now, most people will probably know, but you are in the US. They'll detect the accent. Whereabouts in the US are you?
I live in New Jersey. So I am 2 hours south of New York City and I am 20 minutes east of Philadelphia. So I'm very
Nice.
close to Philly.
Okay, right.
Yeah.
And have you always been in Jersey?
Born and raised.
Nice.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of problems in America in general, but for a state, it's one it, I love it here. It's our home. Even when I travel, I just can't wait to get back. So I've been in Jersey my whole life.
Nice. Now, I guess obviously everybody that I'm chatting to is in some way, shape, or form wrestling with, faith shifts or has wrestled with a faith shift. Where does your story start for you?
As far as my
Big.
faith tradition.
Yeah, big. I guess it's a big question, but everybody would say their story starts at a different point. Where would you say that it starts?
I mean, earliest childhood memories. You know, I don't have any memories not being in church or not being inoculated in like God or Jesus or something. Every core memory I have has faith involved. So really, since the beginning, this has been my life.
And so were you raised in, I guess when we talk about America, we often talk about evangelical Christianity. Is that sort of the image or the upbringing that you had?
Yeah, the term evangelical is really broad and wide, so that could encompass Hillsong. That can also encompass people like John MacArthur, which is more reformed. I grew up in more of the John MacArthur flavor, so a non-denominational kind of Baptist, reformed vibe for a lot of my life, especially my early childhood. My first memories of church was hymns only. There were no, no contemporary music was really a thing. It was kind of unbiblical. That changed later in my life, but yeah, definitely more of that kind of tradition.
And so at what point did your faith, I guess, shift from just the way you were raised to be something that was much more personal?
Well, you know, my faith, I think this is kind of true for a lot of people. Faith for me has always been shifting as I've gotten more and more radicalized by it. I was probably like 12 or 13 when I really wanted to own my faith as being something that I wanted to take on as my own identity instead of my parents' identity. And then I got pretty involved in parachurch ministries. So these are organizations that aren't churches, but are still very Christian and missions oriented. So one of the earliest ones I was ever involved with was, it was called Child Evangelism Fellowship. It's one of the largest missions organizations targeting children. Okay. And they're everywhere. They're in almost, I think, every country. Mm-hmm. And I did missions work with them in my local area as what we call a CYIA or a Christian Youth in Action person. So I would essentially raise my own money, asking my family and friends to donate to then pay myself throughout the summer to do these. They call them 5-day clubs or backyard clubs. They were kind of like a vacation Bible school, but they were hosted in someone's backyard. We would invite the neighborhood kids to come and do songs and games and a Bible lesson and, you know, try and get them saved, frankly. Okay. So I was doing that at age like 14. So I've been pretty involved in that way since, again, since the early years.
I found that most people who have sort of come on in some way detangling faith, deconstruction is obviously, I guess, the hot word to use in this space. But anything in terms of that have always said something similar in that faith was deep. There was an intensity around that from a young age. I think people who sort of come on the other side of it or start to ask questions tend to have that depth quite early on.
Yeah, I mean, it was and it still is deep for me, right? I mean, and everyone has different journeys. Some people end up kind of leaving everything behind in search of a new identity. And I recognize that. I respect it. And it's not a moral judgment for me at all. But for me, it was always about going deeper into my faith tradition. It was never about leaving it. So even the work I do today is birthed out of, I would argue, trying to take my faith very seriously, even more seriously than my fundamentalist upbringing taught me.
Yeah. And I find that, you know, it probably sounds more like that faith shift for you has expanded your faith as opposed to narrow it down.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, some people, I have friends who was on the same journey as I was as a young adult, and they went more to the narrow fundamentalist route of a more exclusive faith. And I certainly have gone the opposite into a much wider and broader faith. With a much wider road, so to speak. So yeah, that's definitely true.
Yeah. You're a drummer, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so when did you, I guess, start to use things that you loved personally for the church?
Oh, the church taught me how to play the drums. So that story is when I was 11, my fundamentalist church, my dad was a guitarist and he gave up everything, you know, hymns only. And we got a new pastor who was kind of radical. And he's like, hey, we should bring some modern choruses into the church, like shout to the Lord and Lord, I lift your name on high, things like that.
Wow.
Right? Like
yeah.
Real modern stuff. At the time it definitely was. And my dad was like, okay, well I can play guitar. And he was like, great. And eventually they thought maybe we should get the drums in here. And, my dad said, well, who's going to yell at an 11-year-old who's playing drums, right? Like that's pretty non-controversial. You can't get mad at the kid. So my dad bought me a drum set and on the bass drum head, it said radical on it. So he duct taped over it to make sure it wasn't a stumbling block for people.
Yep,
and I cut my drumming teeth and my drumming career at the expense of the ears of many people in that church who had to suffer through some pretty shitty drumming. But yeah, if there's one positive thing, I guess, for me is that the church gave me a platform to play music in every week that led me to play professionally. Where to this day, I still play. So that was all because of the church.
Amazing. Gosh, what a way to learn. It's sort of like chucking the kid in the deep end for sure.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, being in Australia, the landscape, we talk about the landscape of religion is really different over here to what it is in the US. And it is, you know, we can sort of see from the outside perspective how embedded in your culture and in your politics it is.
Yeah.
How has that impacted you personally?
You're saying, like, how has that, like, Christian culture impacted me personally? Is that what you're saying? You're asking? Yeah, I mean, well, you can't really get away from it. The work I do today is because of that, right? I mean, I tell people that my faith tradition radicalized me. I'm still doing this stuff today. I just turned the radicalization towards them instead of, you know, the gays or something like that, right? So American culture is steeped in this concept that we are at its foundation, a Christian country, that our founders were Christians, and that we have to get back to some mythical past where everything was good and Christian. Of course, that kind of falls apart when you consider our history of slavery and segregation and, you know, really hurting marginalized groups and queer people, et cetera. But there's still something in the air of like, oh, well, back in the golden era when things were Christian, and we've lost that in the public square because of the liberals or whatever it is. And we have to reclaim that. So, I mean, that was a pretty decent chunk of my upbringing. It wasn't as explicitly political as it is now in some of these more Christian nationalist spaces, but there was always an overtone of, hey, I'll see you at the poll so we can pray. Hey, be bold for Christ in front of your friends. Hey, read your Bible consistently. Hey, go to the March for Life rally in DC to tell your lawmakers to overturn Roe v. Wade. Those things were always deeply embedded in the consciousness of my faith tradition. And I think over time, as I started taking my faith more seriously and really being honest about the questions I had, things weren't always adding up. You know, like, I don't get it. We talk about being pro-life, yet why are so many Christians I know staunchly against things like affordable health care? Or, you know, why can't we get livable wages in the country? And why does it seem like Christians so often are the ones pushing against any legislation to raise wages? Like, it didn't add up. Or why are we so infatuated with gay people? Like, why? Yes. I don't understand. Trust me, they don't want anything to do with our churches. We've made it very clear. Yet, like, that's like our big target is just gay people, right?
Yeah.
So I think those questions I had, even when I was still a more conservative evangelical, I just didn't understand this culture war stuff almost since the beginning. You know, the Starbucks war on Christmas that Bill O'Reilly did like 10 years ago. It just made no sense to me. Like, don't we have bigger fish to fry as Christians than what's on a holiday cup? Like, who gives a shit? Yeah. So I've always been thinking along those lines for a very long time. Even if now I'm much more explicit about it and much more aware of some of the undercurrents beneath it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess it's, you know, it's often really easy to separate our own journey and our own personal faith and spirituality from, I guess, the cultural and political landscape to sort of go, oh, well, you know, it's not what I think, but I'm not really necessarily going to do anything about it or anything like that. What was the moment for you where you were like, actually, no, I need to speak about this. This is not something I want to stay quiet about.
Well, it's kind of complicated because the reality is that I've always been pretty outspoken, even before I took on a more public platform where I'm a little more well-known now in the circles I run in. I remember, you know, when I was 22, I was loud on my own Facebook. I was controversial. I was critiquing the church often. I was not understanding a lot of things that we were doing. So people thought I was controversial. People thought that I hated the church. People thought that I was this or that. So I've always kind of had that persona among friends and family members, you know, and at the time, church leaders, that I was kind of critical and always trying to change things. So this has really been part of my DNA since I was like 18. Okay. I think what motivated me to start New Evangelicals, though, was during COVID, when Sean Foyt, this worship leader, was doing this tour in the middle of a pandemic saying, let us worship. We're going to have these massive gatherings with no masks or social distancing. We're not even going to ask for permits from you know, local officials. And we're going to protest the tyranny of lockdowns and mask mandates. Mm. And at the time, I was a big worship guy. I was a drummer in the worship space. I was making some connections with people. And it was a complete identity for me. You know, being a worship drummer was like all I was obsessed with. And I remember looking at him being like, what? Like, this is so anti what I think it means to love our neighbor. Like, even if you don't like wearing a mask, even if you think masking is ineffective, It's the point is that you're trying to do everything you can to stop the spread of a virus that at the time we had no real solution for, right? Yeah. We didn't know how many deaths it was gonna cause. We didn't know how widely it was gonna spread. And to see someone like Sean be like, "Well, screw that, you know, I'm gonna sing my songs." It's like, dude, again, all about you. Like, is there anything? Is there any give and take here? So I think that that was definitely the moment. I was on my porch when we're all shut down. I thought, we need a new evangelical movement. Like, this is crazy that this is accepted as okay in the evangelical psyche. And so that's how I thought of the name, the New Evangelicals. And then about 2.5 months later, I just went on my Instagram. I changed the name to New Evangelicals, uploaded the image, and I just said, "Hey guys, here I am. No clue what I'm doing. Anyone else concerned about this stuff?" And that's kind of when I fell into the rabbit hole of that deconstruction explosion and people really, the ex-evangelical movement, people thinking things different, thinking about things differently, et cetera.
I guess the movement of deconstruction is only sort of recently in the last couple of years sort of hitting Australia. I think we are sort of, not surprisingly, we tend to be a little behind the times in things, in the way that we do things. And I think they're seeing, I guess, the way some prominent Christian leaders in the US handled the pandemic and those moments where, I mean, I know me personally, I sort of just sat there going, you know, let's read the room a little bit. Like, you know, just even a smidge of awareness would get you so far in this situation.
100%.
And so I think that tended to sort of shine a light on, I guess, just the sheer arrogance around it.
And anti-intellectualism,
yeah,
right? We don't believe the science, it's rigged. I mean, pastors I knew were sharing YouTube documentaries called Plandemic, how this thing was planned. Like, there is in the, and I'm speaking broadly here, it's not every evangelical, but among the evangelical psyche, particularly among white evangelicals, they are just ripe to believe conspiracy theories and to be incredibly anti, you know, anti the establishment or whatever the mainstream way of thinking is regarding science. I mean, and this, you know, when you think about it, it's not exactly surprising considering that so many evangelicals believe in a 6-day creation myth over like the actual science and think that, you know, because of how they read the Bible, that evolution and the Bible are at odds when in reality they don't have to be.
Yeah.
But again, like, I mean, I was taught 6-day creation. I was taught that evolution is a hoax, that it wasn't billions of years. It was 6 literal days because the Bible says so, which by the way, is taking the Bible incredibly unseriously. It's really reading your own modernist ideas into a text that has no framework for that, but I digress. So I do think that a lot of evangelicals are primed to just to think, well, yeah, it's easier to believe that vaccines are killing people more than what COVID's doing, or that maybe we should go to ivermectin instead of whatever scientists say because scientists are liberal elites who just want to destroy everything. Like there's such a conspiratorial hive mind way of thinking about things in evangelical circles. And we saw that even during the 2020 election, you know, at one point 75% of white evangelicals rejected the election process. They believed it was rigged. 75%. I mean, that's a number that should just make our jaw drop, that people could really suspend their belief in data and in the fact that every judge, every lawsuit brought by the Trump administration was dismissed besides one. It had nothing to do with the election anyway. And to this day, half of his team is disbarred. Like it's clear how much they lied. And yet there's no accountability. Evangelicals just move on to the next culture war. It's like, it's crazy town. Again, it's not taking faith seriously. It's not taking their love for Jesus seriously. It's not taking their love for neighbor seriously. It is just a Trojan horse for power and control to maintain the status quo, which just so happens to benefit white evangelicals predominantly.
Yeah, absolutely. I think regardless of the nation, I think there is a general mistrust for the government in general. Sure. And I think, you know, we've very much seen that quite recently with a vote that went to our nation around recognition of First Nations people and bringing a voice for them. And so I think that it is just that general mistrust of the government sort of feeds that narrative. What is it like for you personally on a personal faith, spiritual, new evangelicals aside? What is it like for you personally to see the way that that rolls out in your country? The fierce Christian nationalism that rolls out.
Oh, it's infuriating. I mean, I have to temper my videos a lot now because I want them to be effective. I don't want to rant. I mean, in the beginning, I ranted a lot. I've said a lot of things in rant mode on the internet that I don't take back, but they weren't really as maybe effective as I hoped, right? Mm. But yeah, I mean, personally, this stuff, it's first off, it's absolutely scary. And I'm a white man in America. Like, the system was built for me.
Yeah.
And I'm concerned. I can only imagine how my friends in the BIPOC community and the queer community, you know, other marginalized groups in the indigenous community are feeling, seeing the rise of fascism, frankly, and authoritarianism. I mean, David Gushee, a great scholar of religion, wrote a new book called Defending Democracy from Its Christian Enemies, and he calls it authoritarian reactionary Christianity, and demonstrates how this is kind of happening across the world. This is not like unique to America, and there's definitely a playbook that is applied, like, you know, Viktor Orban in Hungary, et cetera. And he's absolutely right. This is not like a fringe or, oh, they're just crazy. This is a well-organized movement to take power, to control, you know. And these people, at least in America, are not super concerned about democracy. They're not concerned about the Constitution or the rights that it gives. They are more concerned about whatever method it takes to maintain power. So if democracy works at the time for them, democracy is great. Once democracy doesn't work for them anymore, well, you know, hey, maybe an insurrection might help. You know, it doesn't matter the actual like tools that they pull. It's whatever works for them at the given time. So, you know, for me on a personal level, this stuff keeps me up literally at night. I mean, I'm thinking about it way too often. It's in my head. I'm always thinking about how to stop it. What can we do to be, you know, a small drop in the bucket of voices trying to combat this stuff and getting people to vote and vote these people out of office? Because they're bad news for everyone. Even Christians, they're bad news for most Christians in America. Most Christians are not white evangelical Christians. Yeah. So they're just bad news for everyone except for who they see as the in-group, right? Which right now seems to be farther and farther right-wing leaning people.
Yeah, absolutely. How does that then flow on and impact, I guess, your relationships, your immediate family?
Well, we don't really talk about it.
Okay.
I mean, I grew up on talk radio my whole life, you know. I mean, my dad was at the insurrection.
Okay.
I'm not sure. I don't think he was part of the violence, but he was there to see Trump speak. You know, that's just who my dad was and is. And my wife and I made an agreement that we were going to focus on the relationship with them and just be the best parent, siblings and kids that we can, especially now that we have two kids and I want my parents in their life. You know, it's important to me to maintain the relationship. So we just don't talk about it. I don't think my parents know what to do with the work I do. I don't think that they understand it. I don't think that they're really proud of it. I think that their method is, you know, just keep a barrier up, and I'm fine with that. If they want to bring it up one day, I'm down to talk about it. But I just learned that I don't want to argue about this stuff. Like, I'm not going to convince them. They see me as like the little kid. They're the parent who knows best.
Yeah.
So that's just kind of what it's like. As far as other relationships, I lost my church community about 2.5 years ago because of this work. They kind of gave me an ultimatum to either stop doing what I'm doing online or to kick rocks, it was one of the two, right? It was stop what I'm doing. And so you can hang out with us, or you can just get out of here kind of vibe. So I left. I shook their hands after 6 years of, you know, serving with them consistently and left that. So a lot of not a lot, 95% of those friendships are completely toast or evaporated. So, you know, I definitely lost friends over this, but I've also gained a lot of new ones. You know, you gain friends in this space. You get to talk to people that you never imagined you talk to. You become friends with people that you never thought you'd become friends with, people that you might look up to.
Yeah.
You know, that I'm like, wow, I looked up to you for so long and now we're on the phone talking about this stuff. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So it's painful though, you know, and I'm not the only one. A lot of people lose their faith communities and they're lonely. And I think that's why organizations like ours and other places online have become so flooded with people looking desperately for new connections. So it's a big challenge for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. There is a real need, I chatted only yesterday to a guy. His name's Will Small. I don't know whether you know him, but he runs a group called the Spiritual Misfits in Australia. And he's, I guess, trying to find a space where the people who don't necessarily feel like they belong can belong. Because there is a lot of pain, there is a lot of grief, a lot of loss, a lot of trauma from, you know, people who have been, I guess, the ultimatum of stay and conform or leave and do whatever you like, essentially, right. has come right. from the church.
Yeah. And for a lot of people, what's so frustrating is that most of the people I know who got removed from the church or who left, it wasn't over like, did Jesus Christ rise again from the grave? Like, those weren't the questions we were asking. It was like, can we love gay people, please? Could we not be steeped in like this COVID pandemic, you know, conspiracy type thinking? Can we say that Black Lives Matter without getting fired? You know, it was more about the political stances, right? They weren't so far right. Hey, can we fight for affordable health care? Hey, maybe pro-choice is a good option for a lot of people regarding how we approach the abortion issue. And then of course, because of that, they just assumed that theologically we were drifting into no man's land, when in reality, we were just pushing beyond their boundary, right? But the problem is that when you've been told your whole life that the only way to be Christian is this way that you grew up, I call it the basement of, you know, of Christianity. It's fundamentalism. You're just, when you're told that there's nothing above you besides a desert wasteland, and this is all there is, and everyone else who's beyond you is not really a Christian, it's very scary, right? When you get forced out. But when you do get forced out, or when you get so much, or when things get so bad that you leave, you find out that above ground, you're actually still inside a pretty big freaking house full of rooms and different ways of being Christian that are all part of that tradition, right? So it's scary, it's liberating. It's hurtful, but it's also healing all in one. Mm. It's a lot of things at once. And for a lot of people, that's a huge, it's a huge shakeup. You know, the skyscraper of yourself is starting to sway, and it's very unsettling and very scary.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember when I sort of first began detangling my faith, and it was as though the ground was just stripped out from under you. There was so much destabilization. There is someone very well known, and I cannot think of their name, who describes it as a shattering of the self. And it is just, it can just be all consuming. And, but it's often not until you are out or until you, I guess, seeing things from a different perspective and seeing all of the stuff that was potentially happening and how boxed in that was. And so it makes it difficult to see anything different when you have such a limited perspective, a limited, you know, if we think about the basement sort of analogy, if you're only ever in the basement, how are you supposed to know that there is anything else above?
Exactly. Exactly.
So you can only, I tell my clients all the time, you only know what you know. You can't know anything that you have not been taught.
That's right.
And so it very much falls into that category, I guess.
Completely agree.
What, from your perspective, what does this new wave of Christianity look like?
You know, it's interesting. Like, there's nothing new under the sun, right? Like, we're not the first people to be pushing back against our tradition. We're not the first people to be concerned about things going completely, you know, batshit crazy in Christianity. There was the emergent church movement a few decades ago now. Before that, there were all kinds of evangelicals who were trying to push for change. Yeah, I think that this iteration, I think that a lot of people are just kind of fed up, and a lot of people are interested and still want to follow Jesus, but can't do it in these current church paradigms. So I think that there are a few ingredients in that. I think that there's this whole like corporate church thing that just needs to be completely restructured. We have to rethink how we gather as a church. I think that there is a realization that the average pastor cannot compete with the scholarship that's available for free online. I mean, how are you going to compete with Pete Enns? How?
Yeah.
You know, like I think a lot of pastors who have evangelical churches have like a bachelor's, maybe master's degree in divinity. And then you have someone like Pete Enge, who's like, yeah, I'm like 30 years into this. I have a PhD in like, you know, the Hebrew Bible. And and here's what's going on. You're like, oh, well, that's much more credible than whatever my pastor's trying to tell me. Right. And also it's far more interesting. Like, I think for people like me who grew up in that world, it's like, I can only hear so many more 3-point sermons. But about how to be a better me, or how to follow Jesus better, or 3 R's to this, or 3 B's to that. Like, okay, but I can listen to Tim Mackey from the Bible Project for free. The guy is he's like just an amazing scholar. So I think that a lot of churches have to realize that too. Like, hey, people are finding better answers to questions about the Bible from people who are more credible than you. And it is what it is. You know, it just is what it is. I mean, even towards the tail end of my church experience, I was not going for the sermons. I was not going because I was super challenged by the sermons. I was going to be with my friends and to do worship music and to, for friendships and community and to think about these things outside of the Sunday morning. So I think that there's a huge desire for that. And I think that we have to move from these event-centered models to community-centered models. That's really important. And I think that one big difference between maybe this iteration and previous ones is that this one seems to be much more in tune emotionally, right? Terms like gaslighting and trauma and abuse are much more common in the vernacular these days. And I think in the emergent church, I think the emergent movement was more theology, which is great. And I think this movement's more tapped into how we feel. I think that's also really good. I also sometimes get a little concerned that maybe we're overusing some of these terms, but that's not my call to make, right? Like I would never say to someone, are you sure you were really gaslit? You know?
Yeah.
Like we can hold space for that. Right. But I think as we develop and grow, it's important that the language we use is accurate and not hyperbolic or underwhelming either. Right.
Yes.
But I do appreciate that a lot of us are much more in tune to the power structures and how for a lot of us, we encountered God through a hierarchy, usually led by a straight white man. Yeah. And if we went outside of that person's boundaries, we were considered problematic. And it's good to be aware of that. And it's good to know, you know, when maybe we had an adverse religious experience versus abuse versus trauma, and then holding space for each other to kind of learn how to heal together and get back to our human flourishing selves. Right. So I think that's a big part of this as well. And also I do think that a lot of us are much more in tune now politically to what's happening, and we're really concerned, and we really want to start mobilizing and, you know, activating to do what we can to really resist Christian nationalism for the sake of all of our neighbors.
Yeah. I think even over here in Australia, the rise in investment and understanding and just involvement in the political landscape is increasing, and whether that is a generational thing or, you know, a culture thing is probably multifaceted. But you're right, there are terms that are being overused. As a therapist, I'm sort of going, that's not quite the definition of gaslighting.
And
don't get me wrong, there is a fair share of abuse and gaslighting and coercive control and narcissism coming out of church spaces.
But
it is right that we use, I guess, the right terminology and the right language for it. And I think that's what part of my hope was that sort of came out of this podcast, which was, I guess, helping people to get their own sense of authentic language around what they're going through, because it's not talked about a lot here in Australia. It has sort of come about as the rise and fall of the Houstons and the Hillsong Church and things like that. And there has been enormous amounts of pain for people and rage for people around that situation, myself included, my friends. And so I think with that sort of ever increasing situation, I think it just, there is more need for people to have language around their experiences and what they're going through, because it's not talked about the way that it is, you know, diabetes is talked about or something like that. And I think the more that we can have those conversations, the more people will understand what they're experiencing and will develop a more authentic sense of faith and authentic sense of spirituality. But I mean, I guess what I hear when you say like there are other people who we can listen to is we don't tend to make as like, there's no excuses anymore, right? For like pastors and ministers and things like that to have bad theology or inaccurate theology, because there is such a depth of knowledge and ease of access now for the vast population that we sort of go, well, you know, you're running out of excuses a little bit.
100%.
100%. Yeah,
that's right. I mean, you could say we're just being biblical because you're held to a higher standard and we're holding you to it. That's one way you could phrase it, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. I think that the deconstruction explosion that happened certainly let pastors know like, hey, like we're not going to deal with the bullshit anymore, you know? And, you know, I mean, listen, there's always things that I think happen that are maybe a little unfair where I'm like, I'm not sure if it's that, if that's as big of a deal as we think it might be.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of high profile pastors who have done some egregious shit who are still platformed. And it's like, this is why we're calling this out. You know, Mark Driscoll, John MacArthur, Brian Houston, all still men who are in significant portions or areas of power who are still loved and adored by the white evangelical movement. And it's like, have you not seen the trail of bodies these men have left behind or what they say on the internet or how they don't have any sense of repentance or humility? No thanks. So there's certainly plenty. And then, of course, for every one of those major pastors, you have plenty of minor pastors who no one knows about who exhibit that behavior. But also at the same time, there are thousands of pastors who you're never going to hear about who were humble and who model grace and empathy and who are loving and inclusive. So, you know, I try not to treat all pastors the same because a lot of pastors are also casualties of this stuff. I've met plenty of in the beginning stages of this work back in the day. I used to hold a Zoom group for deconstructing pastors. I met several, you know, who were like, yeah, I'm wrestling with this stuff. I want to do better. I run a small church here. You know, there's like maybe 100 of us, you know, et cetera. I mean, in America, the average church is only 80 people. That's the average church size in America, 80 people, maybe 100. It's not big. Yeah. So some of these mega church things, these more high profile pastors truly are not the norm, right? But it's definitely a mixed bag across the landscape. It's certainly not because you're a pastor, you're automatically abusive. I don't want to discredit the work of really good pastors who are trying to live faithfully the call of Jesus. But unfortunately for them, there are a lot of pastors who have used those platforms for power and control and who now are coming under scrutiny for it.
Yeah. Absolutely. And that obviously tends to be the loud in the situation, the loud in the society. And so it is easy to forget that there are people out there who are doing genuine, authentic work with people to try and see change happen.
Right. And the reason that never gets celebrated is because you're doing what's expected.
Yeah.
Right. Like if you say you're a pastor, what you're telling people is that I'm a man of faith. I'm trying to love my neighbor well. I'm trying to be ethical. So congratulations. You did what you said you were going to do. Right. The reason why these stories get a lot of attention when they do harm is because they're so against what they claim that they are being. Right.
Yeah.
I'm a pastor. Also, I'm a narcissist. And, you know, I have this trail of bodies behind me and I'm telling people that I want to tear their head off and it's caught on mic. And 40 of my own elders told me I can't be a pastor anymore. So I started my own church and now I'm a pastor again. It's like, what? That's a problem. That's not pastoring.
Yeah. So, it's like, you know, the complete opposite.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah.
Absolutely. I'm sort of, I guess, wrapping these chats up with people because obviously my purpose was around trying to help people find language and see themselves in other people who are not just someone else telling them how to do things or how to live. They're not, you know, they don't have the same air as the pastor who told them that they can't do something because it's not biblical, or they can't love that person because it's not. And so what would you say to somebody who is like deep in the depths of that deconstruction, who is just like, it's all consuming for them at the moment?
I would say to buy my book. No, I'm just kidding. I don't have a book. Buy my book, 5 Ways to Deconstruct the Right Way.
I was like, am I suddenly interviewing Brian Houston?
Yeah. Great question. In my new book for $29.95, yeah, or just, I know. You know, donate now. No, the beginning parts, especially of deconstruction, are very scary.
Yeah.
They are incredibly scary, right? You've jumped off a cliff. You can't see the bottom. And you hope that it's a soft pillow, not hard concrete. But you don't know. You don't know how you're going to land. Will this destroy everything? Will this ruin your life? Or will you become a better human because of it?
Yeah.
You need to keep going. I can say safely that in the overwhelming majority of people that I've talked to, which really means the ones I can think of, so all of the ones I can think of, everyone who kept going finds a lot of healing on the other side of that process, especially the first hump. I mean, deconstruction and like the commons, you know, understanding is kind of a way of life. You hold even new beliefs a little more loosely than you did before, because the goal is not to become a fundamentalist all over again, right? The goal is to have a different posture, how we approach life, but while still having conviction and being maybe confident in some things, realizing we could be wrong and that's okay. But it takes time to get over that initial hump. It's like, you know, I'm a drummer.
Yep.
And in the beginning years, that beginner's hump is real. It was really difficult to get my hands and my feet to separate even a little bit. It was a lot of hours of practice and frustration and trying to use a metronome. And now, you know, that I'm over that beginner's hump, learning new things is still difficult, but not nearly as difficult as what it was in the beginning, right? Because my body's kind of in shape. It's used to doing certain routines. Deconstruction is like that. The beginning of it, it's a big hump to get over. It's a big cold plunge. It shocks the body. Eventually you warm up. Eventually you get a little more, you know, used to the temperature change, and you start realizing, oh, this actually is way more comfortable than I thought, even if it's still a little chilly at times, right?
Yeah.
So listen, you're not alone. There are plenty of people out there like you who are renegotiating their faith, who aren't sure where they're going to end up, who are scared about that, but keep going. I have to insist, you keep going, you keep pushing through. There is certainly light. And also, I'll tell you this, maybe this is some tough love, but do the work. You know, it is hard work to listen and to read and to reprogram your brain, but you have to be able to put some of the work in to educate yourself, to listen to voices that aren't white men, to read some of the books, to listen to some of these people who have done the hard work already. That will help you in your process as you renegotiate your faith and maybe even your identity.
Yeah. Growth demands discomfort, right?
Oh, that's good.
It's not mine. It's not mine.
I spent 10 minutes trying to, you know, articulate this idea, and you're like, yeah, growth equals discomfort. Yeah, that's exactly right. I could have said that in a couple words.
I would love to say that it's mine, but I'm reading a wonderful book called Women Don't Owe You Pretty, and it's by Florence Given, and she talks about the fact that growth demands discomfort, and you have to be willing to outgrow people, because that's the reality of no longer shrinking yourself for the ease of somebody else. So,
well, thanks, Florence.
Yeah, go Florence.
Go Florence.
it is a little bit like, you know, climatizing to different temperatures all of a sudden. Climatizing doesn't happen overnight.
I agree.
And it happens at different paces. But yeah, you will climatize eventually. And it doesn't
climatize.
Mean you won't.
That's a new word. I'm using that.
Yeah.
I love it.
I'm loving the different analogies that people give around this space.
Yeah.
It's always I love analogies in general. I'm telling my clients we need to move goalposts and all sorts
of
all the time.
All the good shit.
So, but you know, it is something. I think I agree with the do the work. I think there is something about that level of self-accountability to go, actually, you know, I do need to listen to other voices. I do need to do the work. That sounds like tough love, but it's just the reality. The reality is that people shift their faith and they start that process of deconstruction because there are questions, right? So if you want answers that feel authentic and answers that seem to, I guess, satisfy you, you're going to have to look in different places. Otherwise, you're back at square one and you're still getting the same input that you always have.
That's right. I totally agree.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for being up at 5 o'clock in the first morning. Yeah, I know.
I'm so goodness. Not a morning person.
I should be thanking you. Thank you for joining me.
No, I love it. Wow, I really love kind. Chatting to people. So I did put on my social media last night because I had a full day back-to-back of clients. And then I chatted to Will last night. And I was like, and I'm getting up at 5 a.m. morning, people. Give me all of your tips.
Now, are you going back to bed after this?
Oh no, absolutely not. I have training in like 3 hours. So
that means you can get a 2 hour. That's a good chunk of. Listen, you can crawl back into bed, get underneath those comfy comfort.
I mean, look, I probably will go covers. Back to bed. Whether I actually sleep or not might actually just put me out.
That's the $1 million question, right? You know how many times I'm like, oh, I'm gonna take a nap, and then I'm doom scrolling for 45 minutes and 15 minutes left in my time allotted. And I'm like. Yes. Well, that was a waste of my time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, doom scrolling might lead you to wonderful pages on Instagram like the New Evangelicals. Who knows?
Good job, Sam. That's a pro podcast move right there. So.
but if, I mean, obviously the bulk of my connections are going to be in Australia. So if you do not know, jump on. You will learn so much by seeing the landscape of the US.
Yes.
It won't always be good. It won't always be pretty. But we can still learn a whole lot. So, and despite the differing landscapes on a personal level, much of the same experiences are happening. There's still grief, there's still pain, there's still loss, there's still change. And that doesn't, that's not different depending on what nation you are raised in. So
100%
is the differing landscapes. So, I feel like I need to wish you good luck, with some of those things. It's a tough space, I think.
It's a tough one. Space for sure.
Yeah. And I can understand, I call them rage days when things like that tend to happen in the political landscape. Or, you know, there was a school yesterday here in Sydney who decided that they were going to, an all girls school, might I add, that was going to ban their students from taking same-sex partners to the formal. Wow. And I'm like, mate, you're an all-girls school. If anywhere is going to breed lesbianism, it's going to be an all-girls school.
100%. Like, 100%. You know, goodness.
And how are you going to determine what, like, who is a friend and who is a partner? So
ridiculous.
It just is, you know, it's infuriating. But
yeah.
Thanks for joining me. Thanks for chatting.
Thanks for having me.
Going more personal than you might usually on the Instagram page, but jump over. Follow Tim and the New Evangelicals. They're doing wonderful work. So, and it's needed.
Thanks, Sam. That's really kind. It was great talking to you.
Thanks, Tim.
You got it.
Thanks for listening to Beyond the Surface. Until next time, take care, stay true to who you are, and remember, your voice and your story matters, always.